Sweet. Hello, everybody. Welcome to BC is Creepy. I'm Topher Graham.
I'm Ariel Hansen, and today we have another special guest.
Noah Van Buren.
Hello, Internet.
Why don't you tell them
a little bit about yourself.
What you do.
Yeah, what are you?
Well, I am a local filmmaker and director. I run Obsidian Studios here in town, and I'm currently doing freelance work on a bunch of different projects and have worked with you guys on a couple projects before. Ariel, you starred in my monster movie 2 years ago, the Jovian Project.
That I did. Mocap, that was fun.
And I had the pleasure of acting alongside you guys in Paint the Town Red, and me and Topher, we were cannibals, and that was delightful.
I was quite the victim.
One of my favorites.
Yeah.
Is there any news about Paint the Town Red, about the festival circuit?
Well,
the festival circuit is over.
Yeah.
Well, I am a huge fan of Bad Cookie Pictures, and I listened to your show and was so excited when you guys started it. And this isn't the first idea for one of your episodes that I've pitched. When you guys started, I told Topher, I was like, you have to do the story about the feet. The serial killer with the severed feet.
Oh, that was already on our list.
Yes, Ariel got really excited for the feet episode, yeah. So I'm glad that you listened to that and enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Mm. But what have you got for us today? You've got a cool, huge thing.
Well, I was thinking of other stories in BC history. I was listening to some of your crime podcasts, and I remembered it's a story that involves British Columbia, but it also involves a long feud that has gone on between British Columbia and Alberta, where Topher and I are from.
Yeah. Oh, get over it.
And, like, I mean, even today, we grow up and, like, BC is seen as this more, like, liberal province, and, you know,
the best of Alberta, come here.
And Alberta on the other side is seen as more, like, you know, conservative.
Yeah.
But it goes a long way back in history.
Well, I mean, we were there in September, and I will say, it felt more conservative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I found out about this story I'm going to tell you guys. When I was back in Edmonton, I was acting on stage there, and I got a job working at one of Topher's favorite places, Fort Edmonton Park, for a couple years.
I love that place. Incredible. So Fort Edmonton Park is a living history museum where they've built up several different decades in Alberta history with rebuilt buildings and houses from the era that are just refurbished in. And they have actors that come out in costume, and they're often experts in the subject matter, and it's just a really good place to learn history. And I always went there as a kid, and as an adult, I still go there, and it's still just as incredible.
And, like,
Ariel,
guys are back! Fuck!
I've just been following her for, like,
yeah.
Oh my God. A week. Are you sure she's not dead?
Just ignore them, okay?
All right.
Okay, just...
Okay, so I also enjoy going to Fort Edmonton Park, and it was so much fun getting to work there, and I was one of the historical interpreters.
Yeah.
It's the official title for the people who are, you know...
Did you have to have training?
Yeah.
Like, how much training do you go through?
Every year, you go through a couple weeks. You're going over the history. I worked on 1920s Street in the 1920s Midway. So you have to learn all the jargon. You gotta learn, you know, all of the 1920s slang.
Yeah.
And you gotta learn the facts of the era of the Jazz Age. You gotta learn the Charleston dance. And you gotta, for us who worked on the carnival, we got to operate the Ferris wheel, the carousel, and all the different Midway games.
Yeah. I love the Midway Games.
But in learning about Alberta's history in the 1920s, one of the most memorable stories that stuck with me was a story that also involved British Columbia and this huge war on liquor that went on between Alberta and BC. Because Prohibition era, we always think of it as, you know, 1920s gangsters, you know, Al Capone and Chicago.
Yeah, well, because exactly. It was the, we think of the U.S. Prohibition. We don't think of up here, because we were the ones supplying them with the alcohol.
And the supply, like, you know, people know of the tunnels in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
But a lot of that liquor was coming from British Columbia. Because, like, there's a long history for Prohibition in Canada. And it started like back in the mid 1800s. And
we weren't allowed to sell whiskey to Indigenous people.
Yeah, that was the first Prohibition, and that was in the 1860s in Victoria.
Yeah.
And there were other parts, like there was the suffrage movement, you know, the temperance movement. They were huge lobbyists. They were like as powerful back then as like the NRA is now in America, like just
scary.
Lobbyists or being able to influence politicians. And, you know, they saw liquor as a poison that was causing poverty, was causing crime. And
they're not wrong. It is a poison.
Yeah. Yeah.
It did cause crime when it was illegal.
I mean, these were like really persuasive arguments at the time. And the suffragette movement, the leaders of that group were arguing that liquor, it's harming women, it's harming the family because it's making men into drunkards, it's making them abusive, and they're drinking away their paychecks at the bars and putting their family into poverty. So,
you know, these are pretty convincing arguments.
In order for Prohibition to get through, it was really closely tied with the suffragette movement, because that couldn't happen until women could vote. The Prohibition movement gained its first political win in Canada in the 1890s, when it was put into a vote in Parliament, and the majority of people who voted in the referendum voted for Prohibition, except for one province, and that was Quebec.
I could see that.
Yeah, I mean,
they always like to complain and protest, and
I was just thinking they like their drink.
Well, you have to understand, like, the politics and also the religion at the time. The temperance movement was a Protestant movement. I mean, I grew up in Northern Alberta, and they're still the, you know, the Protestant, conservative, Christian values, they're still there. I mean, my grandfather only had one drink in his entire life. And, you know, I grew up with that, where they didn't drink. They wouldn't, because it was
devil water.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, there was such a strong sentiment against it. And
temptation.
Exactly. It's,
I'm drinking a cider right now, and I am very tempted by it.
You know, like, for Quebec, as well as in British Columbia, those had huge populations of Catholics, unlike the rest of the majority of Canada. And for them, for Catholic tradition, alcohol, especially like a drink of wine, was not seen as a sin. It wasn't seen as like morally wrong. And it was, for a lot of people, it was a part of their culture.
Well, I mean, like communion.
Yeah. The people who were supporting it, supporting Prohibition, were people who were fighting for Anglo values. And the people who were against it were largely people from like continental Europe who grew up with it, like having wine at lunchtime, and, you know, you could still get wine at McDonald's in France to this day.
Yeah.
It's a different culture, a different, like, view of alcohol.
I guess I just can't picture my Nana not offering sherry whenever you come over, you know? And she's very British.
But I want to also look at it at, what time frame are we looking at here when they're putting up Prohibition era?
Well, the referendum, because Quebec, they vetoed the national referendum. Wow. So because they didn't, or they voted against prohibition, the national government, the federal government, couldn't enact the law. So they did what the Canadian government usually does. They shrug and say, eh, leave it to the provinces. So they put it up for the provinces to decide, and some of them went for it immediately. Turn of the century, 1900, PEI.
Yeah.
Voted to have prohibition enacted, and they had it until 1940s. Oh. But then for other parts of the country, it took the World War in order for prohibition to go through.
Hmm.
Because for the first time, in especially in Western Canada, there were more women than men.
Yeah.
And like, at the time, before that, in a place like Vancouver, yeah, which is primarily people who are working in the fisheries, they're working in forestry, they're working in the mines.
They're brazen through town, gold panning and stuff.
Exactly. You know, these were rough towns, and they were, you know, populated by guys who were just working back-breaking jobs and just
needed that drink.
As opposed to the more settled areas that, like, you know, farming communities, churchgoers that are raising families. But World War I happened, and suddenly there are more women than men in a lot of these towns when people go overseas to fight. And it was during that time that women finally got the vote in Canada.
Whoa, so not until World War I.
Dear God.
Well, women got the vote, and they pushed through the law also with the saying that it's for the war effort. Like, you're saving grain that could go towards making beer, and you're sending it to the troops. And, you know, if they're off, you know, fighting the Hun, yeah, you know, then we're not gonna waste our money. So there was a huge propaganda campaign from the government and from the temperance movement. Pretty much the way that they phrased it was that drinking alcohol was like, it was the same thing as treason. Like, you were, you know, you were betraying the soldiers, or you weren't doing your part. Spending money on something, you know, so selfish when it could be going to a better cause. And it worked. It was 1917 that BC voted to have prohibition.
Hmm.
That did not last long.
Yeah.
It only lasted until 1920. So it only lasted 3 years, and partly that was because the rum runners, the bootleggers, I mean, it's like anytime something, there's a demand, it doesn't matter if it's legal, like, people will find a way to supply that demand.
We're really good with prohibited substances in BC, I think. We're known for those.
And we're particularly going through a kind of deprohibition currently.
Yeah.
With cannabis and marijuana.
Although our province has fallen behind a bit in terms of...
Which is surprising.
Yeah.
Because we're BC.
It's called BC Bud for a reason.
Yeah.
But you can definitely see the political parallels between how a drug like marijuana, you know, you've got reefer madness, like how it's, you know, labeled as a gateway drug, as, you know, it's destroying the youth, it's corrupting them. It's like the same thing was said about alcohol back then. And there was the same sort of like, yeah, it's illegal, but everyone's still using it. So there's sort of like, it's according to police statistics in BC, 60% of people were drinking, and they were drinking more.
Yeah, as I'm gonna get in trouble for it.
Like, for, like, the unit per person compared to the rest of Canada, which was, like, you know, before, a gallon per person.
Yeah.
It was 7 gallons per person here in BC.
Oh.
Over what period of time? Like, for per month, per year?
Per month.
Oh, okay.
And it's the provincial government, they realized that for them, prohibition wasn't working because people were drinking it anyway, and
they couldn't tax it.
And the fact that the miners, like the people who were, you know, gathering like the natural resources of this country, they were an uproar, especially in places like mining communities up in the Rocky Mountains. And so BC became the first province to lift the prohibition and make it legal again. But even though it was like, even during prohibition, it was illegal to like serve alcohol here, but it was not illegal to export it. So BC, like even in those first years,
you could
was
make
still
it,
making alcohol. And but then after prohibition, it continued and it became like all the rum runners, all the bootleggers in the States and in Canada, most of their liquor was coming from British Columbia. And Vancouver was one of the biggest centers for the rum runners. And
well, we're one of the most southern cities and closest to the States in Canada, really.
Plus we've got ocean.
Yeah.
And by the mid-20s, there were 60 ships that were sailing between Vancouver and the West Coast and all the way to Seattle, to San Francisco, to Los Angeles. This went on for the whole 13 years of Prohibition. And like the most well-known of these rum-running ships, it was called the Malahat. Have you heard of it?
No, because the Malahat is the mountainous part of the number one highway on Vancouver Island. A lot of people die there. A lot of people. Because it's like, basically you're driving on the side of a cliff, kind of. And it gets a lot of traffic, and so it's always like, if there's snowy conditions, it'll get closed. And they'll be like, Malahat's closed!
Well, the Malahat, it was a five-master cargo ship used for shipping West Coast timber. So it worked along Vancouver Island and it worked along the coast. But then when Prohibition came, this was one of the biggest merchant ships in the area. And so it became the most successful smuggler in the entire like Prohibition era. It could carry like 50 to 60,000 cases of liquor at a time. And that's 175 different brands of liquor. What they do is they would sail to a chain of islands outside of San Francisco, and this became known as Rum Row. And Malahat was known as the queen of the rum runners. But these islands, they were in international waters, so that
no prohibition there.
Exactly. They technically weren't breaking any laws. And then the smugglers from America would sail out to them, would barter with them, pick up their liquor, and then they would sail back under the cover of night. Now, the U.S. Coast Guard, of course, knew about this ship, and they tried to catch them. But, you know, they would, like, trail them and try to, like, wait for them to make a mistake. So they were like, you know, but they never were able to. But by the end of Prohibition, they were making so much money that they were able to buy off the Coast Guard. So the Coast Guard still followed them, but instead of like trying to catch them, it would actually catch people who tried to, like pirates or people who tried to hijack
them. They had their own protection.
Exactly. And you know, just a case of rum would, you know,
go missing.
You know, off the record. But the Malahat, according to official records, like after 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt, it's the Depression and Prohibition is repealed.
Yeah.
This meant the end of the rum runners. But they'd made millions of dollars. And it was the end of their empire. And so the Malahat was retired back to shipping logs. And she sailed until 1944 when she was caught in a gale and the timbers inside of her got loose and smashed the hull so badly that they had to abandon ship. I mean, for 40 years, people were trying to find her because she was supposed to have gone down just off of Barkley Sound on Vancouver Island.
Mm.
But divers, after they were looking at some of the records, and there were some like reports and eyewitness reports that the Malahat had sunk off of Powell River, they sent divers down there and they found her just back in the 90s. And you can, you know, if you got your scuba diving license like I do, you can go and charter out a boat and sail to her and dive down to the wreck.
Wow.
It's one of the popular shipwrecks.
That sounds really fun.
And also like Sunshine Coast. Do you know where Seashelt is?
Yeah.
I get the Sunshine Coast. ish.
Outside of Seashelled is a place called Smuggler's Cove. It's a kind of like a lagoon. It's secret. It's nice, hidden away, and it was protected from the weather. That was another favorite spot for the rum runners. The West Coast and Vancouver has a long history of smugglers, of bootleggers, and of pirates.
Now, how can your days make sense?
Yeah, pirates.
That's a story for the West Coast.
Yeah.
But what I want to tell you now is about the war on liquor between BC and Alberta. And this is, I learned this when I was at Fort Edmonton because there were people who were, you know, telling the story. And it is so heartbreaking. It's a tragedy. It's a crime story. It's a mafia story. And it's, I mean, it all focuses around Crow's Nest Pass, which is between Fernie and Coleman, Alberta. So Fernie, BC, right in the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah.
And right next to the border with Alberta. Now,
mountains.
Fernie, at the time of like 1910s, 1920s,
yeah.
Fernie was the biggest like mining town in Canada. It produced more coal than anywhere else in the country. So at the time, it was like, I mean, it's a tiny little town now, but in its heyday, it was bigger than Calgary was at the same time. And so this was one of the places that wanted liquor the most because the miners there were spending 10 hours a day, like, underground. A lot of them, they didn't even get paychecks. Like, after they got they're paid, they got, like, a tab at the local bar, and they would just, you know, drink, and then they would head back down into the mines. And
it's really sad.
They had some breweries there before Prohibition, but when Prohibition happened, it became the center for rum running. And the one man, he's the crime lord.
Pablo Escobar.
The mob boss of Canada and of Canadian Prohibition. His name was Emilio Picarello. And he was an Italian immigrant who had come to Canada to try his life as an entrepreneur. And he run businesses from ice cream stands to grocery stores, eventually owning hotels and saloons. When Prohibition came, he had a monopoly on bottles.
Yeah.
Because there was like a bottling plant, but glass is really hard to get in the Rocky Mountains. He would pay premium dollar to for people to give him their bottles so he'd recycle them and fill them up and then ship them out. So he had a pretty sweet deal. So at the time when Prohibition was coming, he bought up all the bottles he could. And when 1917 happened and throughout Prohibition in Alberta, he became known as Emperor Pick. The Bottle King. He even had advertisements out that labeled him as the Bottle King. You know, the man was like a huge personality, but he was also like, he was, you know, very generous to the community. He was, like when the miners went on strike, he paid to support them and their families. Like he was, you know.
He really does sound like Pablo Escobar.
But the man, he was ruthless. He had a well-oiled operation. He ordered liquor from breweries in town. He had his employees bottle them and hide the liquor in hidden compartments inside of his cars. He originally had older Ford Model Ts,
yeah.
So common, but he replaced them with fast, powerful McLaughlin Buicks, which became nicknamed the Whiskey Sixes. And they came up with many strategies for outsmarting the authorities on the border. For one thing, he bought Hotel Alberta in Blairmore and used it as his headquarters. They dug secret tunnels underneath the town to lead to a hidden cellar inside of Hotel Alberta. So the police never saw, like they knew liquor was there, but they never saw it entering or leaving. And they couldn't find it when they searched the place.
Did they still have them there?
You can go on some, like, tours there. But it was, you know, similar to, you know, some of the tunnels that were dug in Moose Jaw.
Oh.
And so in their vehicles, they'd hide the bottles in hidden compartments, or they'd hide them under bags of real flour so that they would fool inspection. You know, sometimes they'd travel in pairs of two, so the first vehicle would go as a decoy, and if that one got stopped by the police, then the real vehicle with the illegal contraband would just turn back while they're distracted with the others. And they kept this up for years. The Alberta Police, or Alberta Provincial Police Force, the APP, was set up because at the time of Prohibition, Alberta did not have its own provincial police force. And the, you know, police it had were ill-equipped to fight this kind of organized crime.
So this is before the RCMP?
The RCMP had been in Canada, but, you know, they were stretched too thin. So the Alberta Provincial Police were set up. They hired a man to wage this war on liquor. The guy's name was Constable Stephen O'Lawson. He had been the police chief in Fernie. So he knew of Emperor Pick. He knew the other rum runners. He knew their operation, but he was not able to enforce the law in Fernie. He wasn't able to catch them there. So he moved to the Alberta Provincial Police Force with the sole aim of bringing down these criminal empires and to bring Picarello and the other mafia bosses to justice. So this guy, he was fiercely Protestant, and, you know, he was also, this colors some of his prejudice. A lot of the arrests that he made, they were targeted against Italian Catholic immigrants and other minority populations because
they weren't like him.
Well, in Alberta, like, this isn't just him. This was the police force. This was the government. They were there to uphold, you know, English traditional values. And
gross.
I mean, where have we heard this before? That these immigrants, they're bringing crime. They're not sending us their best people. Like, Italy 100 years ago was seen as the same as Mexico is in American politics today. And that, you know, the immigrants are bringing crime. They're destroying our country and our communities, and we have to stop them. It was the political view of the government at the time, and they brought in him to enforce it.
I've seen a very racist Canadian government in past episodes before. Yeah.
So these are the two main figures. And the war on liquor went on for years between these two guys. And Emperor Pick's drivers would smuggle liquor across the border at night. So a Constable Lawson set up patrols along the border. And if they spotted the vehicles, they'd pursue them. And these led to high-speed chases down very dangerous back roads and trails, but the Whiskey Sixes could outrun most of the outdated police vehicles that they had, except the Indian motorcycles. Those were the only thing, but those were from, like, you know, World War One era British equipment that they were given. So they set up more and more roadblocks to try and, like, cover all of these tiny little roads, because there's tiny little back roads and passes that they knew that they would try to sneak past.
So difficult.
But Lawson was never able to pin the crimes on Picarello. And because the police couldn't catch him, Lawson armed his officers.
Yes.
And the chases started ending up in shootouts between the police and the smugglers because this was escalating. And now enter this character. Now, this is the person who, at Fort Edmonton Park, we were learning about, because she's, unfortunately, the center of this tragedy. Her name was, well, the Canadian version of her name that, you know, was changed to was Florence, but her Italian name was Filomena Costanzo Alessandro, and she was born in 1900 and immigrated to Canada at the age of 9 when her family came looking for work. At the age of 14, her father married her off to a man twice her age, Charles Alessandro. It was a very unhappy marriage.
Yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Charles was unreliable, he was getting in trouble with the law, he was abusive, and he was getting them into worse and worse debt. So she was only 17 when Prohibition was enforced in BC. And by that time, Charles had gotten himself and her into deep trouble because he had lost their savings and he owed money to his boss and he couldn't pay him back. And his boss was Emilio Piccarello. So Emperor Pic comes to collect, and Charles is desperate. He's going to do anything to save himself. So he's not able to pay, but Emperor Pic, he wants something else.
No.
He wants Philomena. Oh. But maybe not as you think. He wants her to be a passenger in one of the Whiskey Sixes. This is because the APP were now armed and trying to gun down his drivers. But he knew that the upright, proper Albertan police officers would hesitate to shoot if they saw a woman in the vehicle. Mm. So he wanted her to use as a human shield to protect his operation. So
I feel like this isn't going to go well.
No.
So Philomena, she was not given a choice in this. And she was sent away to work for the Bottle King. And she spent the next years riding as a passenger on their smuggling operations and traveling across BC and Alberta. And I mean, it was a dangerous life and she was in a position she couldn't escape. But even that, she was now trapped in organized crime. Yeah. Being on the road, it actually gave her more freedom than she'd ever had before.
She was away from her husband.
Exactly. It allowed her to be away from her husband. And, you know, for her, it was a happy time. But she learned how to drive, which wasn't common for ladies at the time. And after a while, Pic started sending her out by herself as a driver on solo missions. And during this time, it was thought that one of the things that drew her closer to the crime family was a relationship that started between her and a young man who's one of the other drivers. Mm. And this guy was Stefano Piccarello. Emilio Piccarello's son.
Oh, dear.
And they were the same age. So Emperor Pic decided that they would make, like, the most convincing young couple. So he put them together on runs. And they would just pose when they're going across the border as, you know, a young, happy, married couple just going for a picnic. You know, they grew close, and as they were sent on numerous runs together.
Sounds like her fake marriage is better than a real one.
But everything would change on September 21st, 1922. Constable Lawson was still unable to catch Emperor Pic red-handed. So he gathered his anti-liquor unit, and he set a trap instead for Stefano, his son. When Stefano pulled onto Main Street of Coleman, Alberta, the APP were there and they surrounded his car and they ordered him to stop. He tried to race the police through town and almost got away, but Lawson saw him and fired. One of the bullets hit him in the hand and he was hurt, but he was able to escape and he made it back across the border to BC. It wasn't until evening that Emilio Piccarello heard that his son had just been shot by Lawson, and Philomena was with him at the time. Now, Emperor Pic, he didn't know. Like, he was believing that his son might have been seriously injured or even killed. Like, he was just in a rage. And he armed himself, gave Philomena a revolver, and told her to get into the backseat of his car, and they drove to Constable Lawson's home. To confront him. Constable Lawson saw him, emerged, and before Emperor Piccarello had come, Lawson had sent him a message that his son was under arrest in BC. Now, his son was actually free, but he said that he didn't have his son, but he sent him that message to say, you have to turn yourself in.
Oh.
Because, you know, you're through. It's over. We have your son. We're going to be able to prove that you are, you know, the criminal that we all know you are. And so Constable Lawson sees him and approaches the car. Now, this is where there are multiple accounts of what happened. But what is known is that Lawson and Emperor Pic, they got into a fight, but it's never known to this day. It's not certain who fired the shots. But the account is that the confrontation escalated. The two of them were fighting. Shots were fired. The only witness at the time was Lawson's 9-year-old daughter and his wife, who came to the door after she heard the shots. And all that forensics could prove from the evidence was that the final shot struck Constable Lawson in the back, possibly when the constable turned away from the car to retrieve his own firearm from the home. But Constable Lawson, the champion of the war on liquor, died on his front lawn in front of his family. And the manhunt was out. Like,
you killed a police officer.
You killed a police officer. And that's a thing that they take very personally.
I mean, it goes both ways, because he thought that his son might have been killed, so he's taking that very seriously. But escalation never works.
But the two of them fled. They left the vehicle behind. They avoided the police. But then in Blairmore, the next day, they were both apprehended. Both Piccarello and Philomena were charged with murder, and after a preliminary hearing, they were both sent to trial in Calgary. Now, this was huge. This attracted local and national attention. I mean, Prohibition itself was controversial, and everyone knew who Piccarello was. He had a reputation as this mob boss, and shooting a police officer, it was seen as such a contemptible act. Like, headlines were, like, fueling anger, saying, you know, hang them. The conservatives saw this as proof that the rum runners were the scourge of decent society and reinforced the long-held beliefs that the Italian immigrant communities were full of criminals and they couldn't be trusted. And both of them are charged with murder. That's completely unorthodox, because in any murder case, there's only one murderer. Even if there's an accomplice, somebody may be, like, you know, tried as an accomplice, but there's only ever one murderer. But they wanted to see both of them.
What if they both shot him at the same time?
There's only one bullet to hit him.
I know, but I'm, like, meaning there's situations where two people could kill someone.
It's true, but then you still get the government wanted to make an example of them. And for them, they thought that this was going to be what, you know, would enforce the law. Like, this was going to, by punishing them, make an example of them, you know, they were going to enforce prohibition, and that they were going to end the rum runners.
They were going to scare the country straight.
Well, they were going to, you know, make an example. At the beginning of the trial, Philomena pleaded her innocence, but then she did give a statement saying that she was the one who shot Lawson in self-defense when he attacked Piccarello. And
so took the whole blunt of it.
But when the jury had decided,
yeah,
both of them are guilty, she recanted because she had been persuaded to take the fall by Piccarello because his life was on the line. He wanted to save his own neck. And he told her that, I mean, no woman had ever been hung in Alberta. Yeah. I mean, they're far more lenient towards women. And so
we've seen Alias Grace.
Yeah.
We know.
And so she trusted him. And, you know, there was evidence enough that it was in self-defense, like in the court. But the court was not swayed, and they were both sentenced to hang by the neck until dead. And she went till the end, you know, just professing her innocence. And on May the 2nd, 1923, minutes after Piccarello had been hung, she in turn was led to the scaffolding steps. And she, you know, till the end, you know, she was asking, is there any sympathy? Is there anyone here? But she was the first and the last woman to be hung in Alberta.
Wow.
And, but I mean, after her death, when the hysteria and the anger died down, the public really started to question whether or not she was innocent. And
that's the time when they should be doing that, yeah.
But I mean, it was like,
that helps her.
I mean, the prosecutors at the time had thought that this was going to, you know, win the war on liquor, but it did the opposite. Like, public sentiment and sympathy for her, no, it was just, especially for her, I mean, she was 23. for her, she became a figure in the public's eye. And she's one of the reasons why public opinion in Alberta that was for capital punishment before turned the other way. And also the fact that, you know, public opinion for prohibition started to wane because, you know, the war on liquor wasn't working. And
now they had just a tremendous amount of guilt.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, you know, only a few years after that that prohibition was finally lifted for Alberta. But no, she was... you know, capital punishment was something that still went on in Canada until the
70s.
Till the 70s.
Gross.
But in her book, The Noose and the Petticoat, Lorna Poplack, a Canadian writer, writes about Philomena's life and trial and, you know, how the, you know, public outcry after her execution really changed Canada's view of capital punishment, and that, you know, people decided that we don't want our country to have this anymore.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, but it is a sad story. You know, she is remembered. And in 2003, Canadian composer John Escadio, he wrote Philomena into an opera that tells the story of her life, trial, and her death. And no, it's been it's played around the world.
Wow.
Awesome. All right.
So but yeah, that is a part of our history between our two different provinces. That is like, it is full of tragedy. It's full of just...
But it's full of excitement and drugs and...
and so like...
violence and gangsters. I love it.
I but yeah, this was a Alberta-BC crossover episode.
I quite enjoyed it.
Yes, yes.
We're going to have to, like, rush through your sources.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I can say for, once again, great source is Lorna at Poplack's book, Noose and the Petticoat, or you can find that as part of one of the stories in her book, Drop Dead, A Horrible History of Hanging in Canada. Tell a Story Hive also has a great documentary on it, Secret Alberta, Prohibition, and... For here on BC, there's I'd recommend M. Allen Dale Granger's 1907 book, Woodsman of the West, where he describes, you know, the mining town that Vancouver used to be. Also, a lot of good information from the Vancouver Police Museum about rum running here in town.
Love that place.
But I gotta say, most of it, go to Fort Edmonton Park if you're in Edmonton.
And it's the right time of year.
Yep, you have to go during spring, summer.
Yeah.
It was closed when we were there.
Yeah. Starts around, like, April, goes till September.
Yeah.
But not the end of September.
They do have Christmas. They are open for Christmas and for Halloween. But, I don't have to convince you that it's a great place.
Ariel would have loved it if
I would have gone if it was open.
I know. Heartbreaking. So, that's the... do you have anything you'd like to plug?
Yeah, what's next for you?
Oh, for me, just working on so many different projects right now.
Okay, and where can people find you on the interwebs?
Well, you can look us up at Obsidian Studios. We are always busy on doing our own projects and doing freelance work for other people. But
are you on Facebook?
Yeah,
like, how can they find you on those?
Well, you can look up Obsidian Pictures. But you can look me up on Facebook at Noah Van Buren.
Excellent.
Okay.
I don't have all the social media, like, links. You guys are so, like, organized.
We try our best.
Yeah.
So you can find us at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
You can join our Patreon community where you'll get exclusive access to cool stuff and a shout out on this very podcast if you join. And yeah, I'm at Hanson's Horror on all the social media stuff.
And you can find me on Instagram at Sneezing Wolf.
And if you like cool stories like this, like and subscribe to this channel.
Yes, this pod, also if you're listening to this on like iTunes or Google Play or anything like that, if you like the podcast, please rate and review.
And as always,
stay creepy.